Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast of the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so as we go over recent developments in the public safety, labor, and employment world. I want to start with a little bit of an update. I know I sort of battered you over the head for the last 2 months about the need for public safety employees to stop posting stupid stuff on social media sites. I just want to give you a bit of an update on what the current state of play is with respect to the fallout from what's known as the Plainview Project. You'll recall the Plainview Project is an effort by a Philadelphia attorney to identify Facebook posts of law enforcement officers in 8 different jurisdictions, Facebook posts that the attorney deemed were racist or sexist or advocated violence or were religiously intolerant or were in some way or another offensive. And there was an immediate and huge national reaction to her effort. She posted in a database, an online database that you can get to by going to the Plainview Project's website. She posted what it was law enforcement officers in these 8 jurisdictions had been saying on Facebook, and all 8 law enforcement agencies began investigating the officers that she identified in this database. So what sort of update do we have as to what's gone on with respect to those officers? Well, let's start with Philadelphia, where the action, I think, has been the swiftest and also possibly the most severe that we will see coming out of this. And in Philadelphia, you had 72 officers who were placed on desk duty or administrative leave with pay. And eventually, the department decided to fire 13 of them for their social media posts, for their Facebook posts. 7 of those 13 resigned, and that leaves 6 who have been fired, who, the last I heard, their union, the Fraternal Order of Police, was in the process of evaluating whether or not to challenge those terminations in arbitration. There were a host of other officers who were disciplined, either with suspensions or reprimands and the like. And that seems to be it in terms of Philadelphia. It doesn't look like there will be any more disciplinary actions taken in Philadelphia. Another big one was St. Louis, and in St. Louis, the action was a little bit different. While the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department is investigating those social media posts, the local district attorney, she's known as a circuit attorney in St. Louis, almost immediately put 22 officers from the department on her Brady list, or as she puts it, her exclusion list. She is saying, I'm not going to call those officers as witnesses in criminal cases. And so we're going to have to see how that plays out, whether or not there'll be a legal challenge to her doing that without anything that's remotely due processy, right? She's just simply reacting to the post, making a judgment, not giving the officers a chance to be heard. We'll have to see how that one plays out, and also the disciplinary action that, if any, that is taken against those 22 officers. Then there's a small jurisdiction. It's Denison, Texas. It only has like 24,000 people, and it was, for some reason, one of the 8 jurisdictions identified by the Plainview Project. And what has happened in Denison is that we've had 2 officers who the department decided to, at least initially, fire. It ended up being one officer who it intended to terminate, but he's now no longer with the department for other reasons. One received a written reprimand, and 2 others were, in the words of the chief, appropriately counseled. There have been interesting developments as well in Phoenix. The Phoenix police chief immediately pulled 12 officers off the streets and announced an intention to investigate all of the Phoenix officers whose posts were identified by the Plainview Project. So far, I have not seen any results of those disciplinary investigations published, but what has happened in Phoenix that's been very interesting has been the union has publicly announced that it is investigating whether or not there are services out there that can scrub the social media accounts of its members. The union is the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association, PLEAS, it's usually known. And the news stories about this scrubbing service indicate that there are some that are available for $3 a month per individual. When PLEA announced that it was going to look into the scrubbing service, it immediately came in for condemnation from some people in the community who were saying, no, you're just simply trying to erase evidence of the officer's misconduct. I haven't seen word yet on whether PLEA actually went through and implemented the scrubbing service, purchased it for its members. The last jurisdiction I want to talk about is the Dallas Police Department. In Dallas, 4 active duty officers were placed on administrative leave. 21 others were placed in the middle of internal affairs investigations. Last count, there have been no disciplinary decisions made in any of those cases. Before I move off of social media, I do want to talk a little bit about an odd case in that these are police officers who are working for a private university, Hampton University in Virginia, which is historically an African-American university. It fired 9 of its campus police officers. I can't find how big the campus police department is for Hampton University, but I'll bet you 9 is a pretty big chunk of the entire police force. What these officers were doing was they were engaged in what is described as a meme war. So what the meme war theory is you go out there, you find these memes on various web pages, and you try to escalate a battle with other people as to who can find memes that are funnier or more offensive or more outlandish. And in the eyes of the university, 9 of those officers crossed that line. I would be shocked if any of those officers have any employment rights to the job. This is Virginia. There are no police unions in Virginia that have any collective bargaining rights. I'd be shocked if the only possible claim the officers had was potentially under the First Amendment, and those claims are going to be very difficult to make. Now, I want to conclude with just a little bit of advice to everybody, and then I'll stop beating this drum. 2 pieces of advice. First, from the Hampton University case, there are all sorts of law enforcement. That's just law enforcement. There's also firefighter memes that are out there that you can find that are offensive. Some of them are published on Facebook pages and other social media pages. They're collected there. There's a huge police humor Facebook page that has something like 500,000 followers. Memo to everybody. Just because you find a meme somewhere on the internet doesn't mean you should either publish it or expect to be free from discipline if you publish it. Anytime you are posting something, you are engaged in your own conduct. You're making a decision about it, and you are potentially subject to disciplinary action for that decision. Second piece of advice. If you're a public safety employee, I hope you think twice, 3 times, and 5 times about whether it is worth it to you to have a public safety presence that in any way, explicitly or implicitly, identifies you as a public safety employee. honestly, if I was a 22-year-old contemplating service as a corrections officer or firefighter or a police officer, I wouldn't be doing it. The risks are just too high. And you know what? We can argue back and forth as to whether that's right, whether it should be the case that public safety employees have less rights to publish stuff on social media than other employees. What I'm concerned about is that we have very good evidence that public safety employees are being held to a different standard than everybody else with respect to what they're posting, and that we are losing police officers and firefighters around this country to these posts. Stop it. Okay, let's talk about something less depressing, okay? There's a really fascinating case that comes out of Massachusetts, and this is coming from the Massachusetts Labor Relations Commission, actually an administrative law judge there. And it's a fascinating case because it involves the intersection between three things. And those three things are an employee's due process rights under the Supreme Court's decision of Loudermill versus Cleveland Board of Education. So it's a constitutional case. Secondly, the union's duty of fair representation and the scope of that. And third, the employer's obligation to share information with the union about disciplinary cases. So how do all of those three things come together in the same case? Well, this is a case that involves the town of Auburn, Massachusetts. And the police employees there are represented by what's known as the Massachusetts Coalition of Police. And one of the members of the coalition is a dispatcher by the name of Maureen McLean. And the department begins investigating McLean about a call she took on July 11th, 2017. And as the investigation expanded, the department started looking at other calls and how McLean had handled other calls. She gets placed on administrative leave. The department issues a preliminary disciplinary decision. McLean requests a Loudermill hearing, a due process hearing, and the coalition steps in, says, we're going to represent McLean at the Loudermill hearing. We want a copy of all relevant audio recordings and all investigatory documents with respect to the calls. The employer, the department, gets this request for information. It partially responds. However, it redacts certain documents, and it refuses to provide other documents to the union. The union, of course, the coalition, files an unfair labor practice complaint and says, look, the department's decision to withhold this information violates its obligation to share information relevant to grievances and potential grievances. Let me go off on a sidetrack for a moment. Why would the department withhold that information? I mean, I've just got to say that sometimes I don't understand the thinking that goes into these, we're not going to do this sort of decision. So in this case, if you're the employer, you know if you issue final disciplinary action against dispatcher McLean, you know the union's going to be able to get all this information in the run-up to any arbitration or whatever disciplinary appeal system exists in Auburn, Massachusetts. You know they're going to get it sometime or another. Why not give it to the union before the Loudermill hearing so you understand the full scope of the union's fully developed arguments? And you can make the best decision possible after the Loudermill hearing. Why wouldn't you give the union everything it wants? Well, for some reason, the town of Auburn didn't, and that gave us this unfair labor practice complaint. So how does this case get resolved? Well, the administrative law judge starts with a pretty basic proposition. The obligation to bargain in good faith includes with it an obligation to share information relevant to mandatory subjects of bargaining, anything that's negotiable under the law. So, for example, an employer has the right to ask the union, tell us what comparable jurisdictions you are using when you're in negotiations. That's relevant to the bargaining process, relevant to the mandatory subject of bargaining of wages and hours and the like. So the union would have to disclose that information. Well, this obligation to share information relevant to the bargaining process extends to grievances and potential grievances. So that whenever you do have a grievance or a potential grievance, the union can tell the employer, give us everything you've got, and the employer has to do so. And if it doesn't, it will be in breach of its obligation to collectively bargain in good faith. So the ALJ starts with that basic proposition that the stuff that the coalition wanted here, that stuff generally has to be produced. What's the town's argument? The town's argument is Loudermill, this hearing that the union wants this stuff for, Loudermill is not a union rights issue. It is a constitutional protection. And because Loudermill rights, these due process rights, arise out of the Constitution, they are individually held rights. That means dispatcher McLean has Loudermill rights. The union doesn't have any, argues the town. The union is not acting, therefore, in its capacity as the exclusive representative for employees when it's representing McLean in the Loudermill hearing. It's just like any other representative, like an attorney who might show up. We don't have the obligation to give any of those people the information the union is asking for, and simply because this is the union with whom we also have a bargaining relationship doesn't mean we have to turn this information over in advance of a Loudermill hearing. You get the argument? It's basically that the union is functioning kind of as a private attorney and not as a union, not as the exclusive bargaining representative for employees. How does the administrative law judge deal with that? Well, first of all, he doesn't like the argument. He ends up rejecting it. And here's a couple of lines from the ALJ's opinion. The information sought by the union was relevant to carry out its statutory duties in representing McLean at the Loudermill hearing because it pertained to the terms and conditions of her employment with the town. Although the town maintains that the union was not entitled to the requested information because the arbitration procedures of the party's contract didn't apply to Loudermill proceedings, the relevancy standard doesn't require the existence of pending negotiations or pending grievances as a condition precedent to the union's right to request requested information. In other words, and I know that those few sentences do require a bit of an English language translation. In other words, even though the union may not have had a duty of fair representation to represent McLean in that Loudermill hearing, because the rights to the hearing arose out of the Constitution, once the union chose to represent her, and it had the right to do that, it was acting as the union, and it had the right to information that was relevant to a potential grievance to be filed on behalf of McLean. The administrative law judge ends up concluding that none of the unions, I'm quoting again, none of the unions' multiple requests for information specifically sought confidential methods, tactics, or law enforcement practices used by the union that could have impeded the town's ability to investigate McLean. Without more evidence, the town can't show that its disclosure of the requested information would have prejudiced the confidential nature of its operations. Bottom line, turn the information over. Interesting case, right? Loudermill, the duty of fair representation, all come together in the same case as the employer's obligation to share information relevant to the bargaining process. Next up, a puzzling case from New York involving a police officer from the village of Yorkville in New York. This is a guy named Kent Donnelly. I'll tell you why it's puzzling. It's an ADA case. I'll tell you why it's puzzling after I let you know what the facts are in the case. So what happens here is way back in 2011, the village gets a complaint from a resident regarding an incident that she had had with Donnelly when he was on duty. And it claimed that Donnelly had approached her and her daughter in the resident's fenced-in backyard at about 10:30 at night and shined a flashlight at them without identifying himself. The complaint also alleged that Donnelly had threatened to shoot their dogs if they didn't bring them inside the house. Later in 2011, a probation officer told the police department that Donnelly had what's known as an order of protection, the equivalent of a TRO, that had been issued against him by the mother of his child. And this is a woman named Jessamine Harder. Harder contended that Donnelly had sent her a bunch of text messages and emails that made her worry that Donnelly was going to harm himself. The mayor and the village board, this is a small town, as you might imagine, talk about various alternatives as to what they're going to do with Donnelly, and they decide fitness for duty evaluation. And they send Donnelly to a local psychologist. Donnelly consents to it. Psychologist is a guy named Toby Davis, who performed a fitness for duty evaluation. Now, here's where it's going to start to get a little bit confusing. Dr. Davis issues a report that does not diagnose Donnelly with any mental, emotional, or psychological disorders, but does say that Donnelly exhibited various personality traits. What are those personality traits? I'm going to quote here, including narcissism, a sense of entitlement, a sense of projective power due in part to his position as a police officer, lack of self-awareness, and diminished self-monitoring ability. The department gets that fitness for duty evaluation, fires Donnelly, and Donnelly sues, claiming he's the victim of disability discrimination against or under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And he sues in federal court. And a federal court ends up dismissing the lawsuit because it concludes that Donnelly is not disabled. Well, first of all, are mental impairments covered under the ADA? Are they a disability under the ADA? And the answer is yes, if they fall within the ADA's definition of a mental impairment. What's that definition? That comes to us courtesy of the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. And the EEOC says that a mental impairment is any mental or psychological disorder, such as an intellectual disability or organic brain syndrome, emotional or mental illness, and specific learning disabilities. The court looks at that definition and says, Donnelly doesn't fit. The court says, look, Dr. Davis found that Donnelly had all of these different personality traits, narcissism, a sense of entitlement, et cetera, but he did not make a finding that, and I'm quoting, these personality traits were symptomatic of any mental, psychological, or emotional disorder. In fact, Dr. Davis did not diagnose Donnelly with any mental, psychological, or emotional disorder at all. And Donnelly does not, in fact, suffer from any type of mental illness. As such, Donnelly's personality traits do not constitute a disability, and therefore rejects the lawsuit. Now, why do I find this puzzling? And the reason it's puzzling, I think, comes right back to Dr. Davis's opinion. Remember what he says here. He says, Donnelly's got these personality traits. What's the first one on the list? It's narcissism. Is narcissism a personality disorder? And remember that if you have something that is a diagnosable personality disorder, you are covered by the ADA. It covers any mental or psychological disorder. So to find out if something is a diagnosable psychological condition, where do we go? We go to the edition number 5 of the DSM, the DSM-5. What does that mean? That is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. And this is updated once every 10 years, and it is put together by hundreds of international experts who are pros in all forms of treating and diagnosing psychological conditions. What do we find in DSM-5? We find, as a diagnosable condition, narcissistic personality disorder. What does DSM-5 say about it? It says narcissistic personality disorder, quote, is a cluster B personality disorder defined as comprising a pervasive pattern of grandiosity in fantasy or behavior, a constant need for admiration, and a lack of empathy. I'm going to pause for a moment while you think of all the people in your life who you think might have a narcissistic personality disorder. So, at any rate, that's a condition under the DSM-5. Why is the court concluding? Why did Dr. Davis say that Donnelly did not suffer from any sort of mental or psychological disorder? Maybe Donnelly didn't even argue that or think to argue it. It just strikes me as a pretty puzzling decision. Now, I will say, without regard to that confoundment under which I find myself, without regard to that, the court's decision structurally is a correct one. I mean, you do go through the list of what mental impairments are as defined by the EEOC to see whether or not the employee's got one of those impairments. It's just strange to me that we find a pretty obvious psychological condition that is diagnosed by this doctor. He identifies it, he lists it, and yet it doesn't play a factor in the court's analysis. Interesting case. Let's come over to Nebraska now to continue what has been a really cool month of interesting cases out there. We've got a pretty delicious Garrity case coming out of the Nebraska State Patrol that emphasizes the two-part analysis that always happens in most of these Garrity cases today. So what goes on in this case? This involves a trooper by the name of Christopher Kober. Kober becomes the subject of an investigation when the local police department, the Bellevue Police Department, gets a tip from Kober's wife. And the tip is that there are a large amount of prescription drugs in an ammunition can in the basement of Kober's home. The Bellevue Police Department goes out to the home. Indeed, there was a large amount of prescription drugs in the can. The patrol puts Kober on administrative leave, takes away his badge and gun, and gives him a memorandum detailing the charges against him. So he's under disciplinary investigation at this point. As part of it, he's given a Garrity warning. And the Garrity warning says, Kober, you're ordered to answer questions in an IA investigation, and neither your statements nor the fruits of your statements can be used against you in a subsequent criminal proceeding. So we've got this internal affairs investigation going on. The patrol gets in touch with Kober and says, look, we got another tip. Guess from who? We've got another tip, and We want to know about those six boxes of ammunition with patrol labels that are in your home. An investigator talks with Kober. Kober says, you know, it's possible I'm a range instructor. I may have brought home some ammunition and put it on a workbench in my basement. Once Kober learns of these allegations, though, Kober and his brother promptly remove all ammunition and firearms from Kober's home. Good move, right? They transferred it to the brother's home, and the whole idea is we don't want to be the subject of any more allegations from Kober's wife. Kober is again questioned. He is asked to produce all of the patrol's ammunition. He mostly complies with that, but he doesn't return at all. He is the subject of a formal internal affairs interview that is preceded by more Garrity warnings. He gives a statement, and then the local district attorney's office, the Sarpy County attorney, files criminal theft charges against Kober. He files a motion to suppress his statements and the fruits of his statements. A trial court agrees with Kober, suppresses the statement, and the state appeals. And thus we end up in the Nebraska Court of Appeals with the question, does Garrity versus New Jersey prohibit the use of Kober's statements in the criminal proceeding? And the court says there's a two-part test. This is a two-part test that goes way, way back under Garrity, all the way back to a case known as United States versus Camacho. It's about 35 years old now, 30 years old, involving a allegation against a Miami police officer. What's the two-part test? The two-part test evaluates whether someone is compelled to give a statement such that the self-incrimination provision in the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution is triggered. How do we know whether or not they are compelled? How do we know whether or not their statement is voluntary? And the courts have said, starting with the Camacho case, the courts have said, we ask two questions. Number one, did the employee have a subjective belief that he or she was compelled to give a statement on threat of possible job loss if they did not give a statement? So, in other words, did they think they'd be fired if they didn't give a statement? And two, was that belief objectively reasonable? Well, in Kober's case, the state doesn't fight over the first one. He believed he was compelled to give these statements, the formal IA statement, and as well the interchange with the investigator about the ammunition. He clearly believed that. Was that belief objectively reasonable? Would a reasonable employee under the same circumstances have believed it? And the court says yes. And I want to read you a few sentences from the opinion, and I want you to pay very careful attention to the first of these sentences. Here, it is clear that the patrol's policies, rules, and regulations subjected Kober to possible termination from his job. But the totality of the circumstances coming soon after the origination of the initial investigation into the drugs found at Kober's home combined to make Kober's subjective belief objectively reasonable. Kober had been recently relieved of his duties, along with his badge and gun, served a Garrity warning, and understood that his job was in serious jeopardy after the drugs were found in ammunition canisters in his basement. Days later, he was questioned as to the ammunition that was similarly found in his basement. Under these circumstances, Kober's belief was objectively reasonable, and his statement must be suppressed. Why did I want you to focus on that first sentence? There's a fair amount of controversy in the courts about whether or not an employer's rules standing alone are enough to trigger the Fifth Amendment. So, for example, most employers have rules that a subordinate must comply with a supervisor's questions, must answer the supervisor's questions, must write a statement if the supervisor says so. What if the department's rules very clearly indicate that if an employee violates this rule, and usually it's part of a code of conduct, violates any of the rules in a code of conduct, is subject to termination, does that standing alone make an employee's belief that they would be required to answer questions, does it make that belief objectively reasonable? And most of the courts that have decided the issue say the rules standing alone are enough. Some courts have said no, but what is clearly the case is that those rules play a factor in a court's evaluation of the reasonableness of the employee's belief. Like in Kober's case, the court says, you know, we looked at the rules. The rules say you don't answer questions, you can be fired. That's the first thing the court says. But, says the court, you add on the additional stuff. He's placed on administrative leave. They take his badge and gun. That it's clear he's under investigation for some serious charges. We add on that additional stuff, and it is very clear that the belief that he was ordered to answer questions was reasonable. And whenever you have that finding, you're going to have statements by the employee suppressed in a criminal proceeding. This is a pretty standard Garrity case, and I bring it up only because it's an illustration of this two-part process, a process that's not, I think, always well understood by public safety employers. Incidentally, sometimes I hear from firefighters to say, well, what does Garrity have to do with me? You know, I'm not investigated for things where potentially they are a crime, and Garrity only provides immunity in a criminal prosecution, so why am I necessarily concerned with my Garrity rights? And then I talked to other fire unions who are pretty, they understand the whole issue pretty well. Firefighters, corrections officers, all public safety employees, all public employees for that matter, can be investigated by their departments for departmental violations that are also, if provable, crimes. So, for example, any allegation of theft, and that is a charge that is treated with utmost seriousness in the fire service, that has Garrity implications. An intersection collision where you have a firefighter who was driving, that has Garrity implications. There are assault cases that have been brought against fire. It goes on and on and on. And the bottom line is that any public employee better know the rules with respect to Garrity. I want to conclude today's podcast by talking about a case that many of you are not going to believe really exists. It's totally a blast from the past, something that was very common 70, 80, 90 years ago, but doesn't happen much anymore, and that is employees who are fired as part of a political patronage system. So what is going on here? This is a case that involves two deputy marshals for what is known as the Civil and Magistrate Court of Richmond County, Georgia. And the marshal's office is a law enforcement agency that provides security at various public buildings and has the ability to investigate and issue citations for violations of ordinances and the like. The marshal himself or herself, that is an elected job, and they below the marshal, you have the typical chain of command, a chief deputy, a captain, and the like. This case involves Mallory Jones and Troy Moses. So Jones has been employed as a deputy marshal on and off for 23 years. I'm calculating wrong here. From 1993 to 2016, When he was first hired back in 1993, Steve Smith was the marshal. And Smith remained the marshal and hired Jones each time he returned. Eventually, Smith promotes Jones to lieutenant, and he ends up being captain. He's doing administrative work, largely public speaking, working with the community, and the like. The other deputy involved in this is Troy Moses. Moses has been a deputy marshal from 2008. He was a sergeant. His primary duties were community relations, public speaking, going to schools and nursing homes, and attending neighborhood associations. Then in 2016, something fateful happens. Somebody else runs for marshal. Ramon Lampkin decides to run for marshal of Richmond County. Jones, who has participated in Smith's campaigns in the past, does so on this occasion. He posts things on social media about things that Smith had done over the course of the year. Moses also supports Smith, and he's supporting Smith because Smith is saying, this is the last time I'm going to run, and Moses wants to replace him the next time there is an election, which would be in 2020. Moses wore campaign shirts supporting Smith, took pictures with Smith to post on social media, and encouraged his family and friends to support Smith. You know how this is going, right? Lampkin won the election, and he assumed office in January 2017. Immediate pink slips to Jones and Moses, citing the fact that they opposed Lampkin in the election. Jones and Moses sue, claiming their terminations violated the First Amendment rights to free speech, and the case ends up before the Federal 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, in most parts of the country, in fact, in all parts of the country, this is a slam dunk case. But in most parts of the country, it comes out differently than it does in the 11th Circuit. In most parts of the country, this sort of discharge for political activities would be a per se violation of the First Amendment, so long as the employer couldn't prove that what it was, whatever statements it was that the deputy marshals made were false, or there was some sort of harm to the department. Off-duty police officers do have the right to engage in political activity, and political loyalty is not a criterion for the job of police officers in most parts of the country. But there are still a few places, almost all in the Deep South, where political patronage systems are legal. And one of them is in Georgia. And the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals says that Lampkin had the right to fire Jones and Moses for liking his opponent on Facebook and the limited campaigning that they did. Why? What is the court saying? The court says, under Georgia law, a marshal, and I'm going to quote, has the discretion to appoint and remove deputies. Because as deputy marshals, Jones and Moses had the same powers and duties as the marshal, and because the marshal had the discretion to appoint and remove them, they were his alter egos. Thus, Lampkin was permitted to terminate their employment based on a political reason, their support of his opponent in the election. I can hear the collective shudderings from many of you that this is still the law anywhere in the country. It's going away. Courts are doing away with this, you know, kind of like one state at a time, but it still does exist. I will tell you, I don't know of any place that it exists where there is collective bargaining. Those two are kind of fundamentally incompatible. But in Georgia, there's no collective bargaining for anybody, law enforcement, fire protection. And so it's not unsurprising to find that in a small county in Georgia, in a marshal's office, that a political patronage system is being blessed as permissible by the courts. Well, that's it for the September 2019 edition of First Thursday. We hope you'll join us for our next premium podcast. We're going to have an interesting discussion with a management side attorney about the various state statutes that are being enacted around the country that impose greater obligations than federal statutes such as the ADA or the Family and Medical Leave Act and the like. I really enjoyed the conversation when we recorded it last month. I think you'll get a kick out of that. That'll be part of our premium podcast series. We also have a seminar coming up on grievances and arbitration. That'll be held in the third week of September in Las Vegas. You can find out about that at our website at LRIS.com. And as always, remember, go to iTunes and rate us, because even if you don't like us, it apparently helps. I hope you like us, but even if you don't, it apparently helps us if you go and rate us. It pops us up to the top of some queue or another. With that, thanks for listening. This is Will Aitchison signing off.